name is Clancy Emerson, I'm an alcoholic. George, don't go into telephone sales. I'm glad to be here this afternoon. Talk on this subject. Talk again. I didn't realize that I was going to be like a yo-yo this weekend, about every 36 minutes, and now we're all welcome Clancy. I like to talk on some other subject. I really should have thanked Barney for his talk. I was so tired, so I was sleepless. I went to my hotel, took a nap, and I knew if I didn't thank him, he wouldn't probably show up for this meeting, so. I don't want anyone to mention it to him. We're taking up the subject of action is the magic word, which is certainly, I would say, most of the people in this room are familiar with because you're here. The trouble with these little weekends and the trouble with little pockets of enthusiasm and get-togethers and things like that is that, as the old saying goes, you wind up preaching to the choir. You wind up preaching to the people who believe it, which is why they're here. And the people who need to hear it are too apathetic to come. So we wind up really as kind of at least we reinforce one another so we remember why we're here. I think that would be a great example. To start off with the history of action in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't hear Tom talk last night, but I'm sure he mentioned it in one way or another. So we have Bill Wilson getting sober through his spiritual experience in Towns Hospital. Then for the next 6 months, trying to help people, bringing these terrible wretched drunks to the Oxford movement, and these people are kind of upper class, middle class, and upper class people there for spiritual enlightenment, and he's bringing these seedy old goofs with puking on their shoes, and finally he gets his job to go to Akron, Ohio, okay? Well, after 6 months he stays sober. And a great moment in the mother's wife where he gets up one morning and the guy he brought home the night before has burned him off. One more guy has burned him off. He's all these people he's helped that burned him off. The guy he brought home last night now, he brought home several guys over a period of time, which is here tonight. Most of them stolen something and snuck out. The guy he brought home last night stolen something and snuck out. And he realized himself. He watched his wife, this first class society lady, putting on her kind of a patch for his sweater to go to work as a counter girl, and she's trying to support everybody. And he says to himself, this is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. I keep trying to help these drunks, so I need his help, and my poor wife is losing her life away back to that stinking department store. This is ridiculous. And his owner says, Lois, I'm not going to do this anymore. I learned my lesson. I've been doing this for 6 months, and not one person has stayed sober. And of course, she said a great line and saved your life and mine and changed the course of history. I was having lunch with her a few years ago in Hartford, Connecticut. I said, Lois, how did you ever think of that great answer? God has changed the course of history. So it seemed so obvious. I thought, I didn't understand why you didn't say it too. Thinking all over what she said, he said, I'm not going to do this anymore. Not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did. And he said, oh yeah. That's why I laugh every time I don't have much hair in the front. They go, oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, I see that now. And so he stayed sober. He got to a job out in Akron, Ohio. Got in the proxy battle, some stocks for some company out there. He went out there and the deal blew up. And he wound up, as was mentioned, standing in the lobby of the hotel. And through a series of circumstances, most of us in this room are familiar, we called, finally made a call to a minister who put him in touch with some people, some who didn't want to talk to them, one finally did reach out to me, Mrs. Seiberling. And the next day he went out to her guest house and met this drunken doctor. And he decided to stay in Akron for a while to see if he could help this guy. So one of the wealthy people put him up in a country club where he stayed in a little bed of a country club. And he worked with the doctor every day, went over his house every day, and helped him. And they discussed, because Bill had been in the Oxford movement. Dr. Bob had been in the Oxford movement. He'd been a spiritual leader in the Oxford movement, kind of in a minor way. And they discussed spirituality and the depth of God's love and insights. And then 2 weeks of this, Dr. Bob, if you know the story, decided to, first time he felt this good, segment, he decided to go to the American Medical Association convention in New Jersey, went there on the train. We met him 2 or 3 days later, got a call from his office nurse, Dr. Rob's office nurse, calling his house at early in the morning and saying, you know, I'm so sorry to tell you this, but the doctor's back in town, he's terribly drunk. They called me from the station and went down and found him drunk on the platform. And I went on the floor of his office, I don't know what to do, I'm so sorry. So Bill and his wife were out of thunderstruck, and they went down and they helped him, they brought him home. And he was in bed sick for a couple of days, and finally, one day he realized, I forgot about it this morning because I got to do cancer surgery. He was a proctologist, did a lot of cancer surgery. He said, I'm so sick, I got to do it today. And I look at my hand, I can't hold that knife, So his sponsor went down and got him a drink to steady his hand. He went in there and did that surgery and put down the knife and put down the drink. And at that moment is the birth of Alcoholics Anonymous, June 10th, 1935. But what I was trying to point out is that they continued to decide to try it again. But they had learned something, and Bill thought about it, I suppose, that their 2 weeks of intense spiritual discussions hadn't kept Bob sober. And all the spirituality that should have gone in didn't help. And when Bill looked back, that isn't what kept him sober. What kept him sober was dealing with their boobs and bringing them home and taking their Oxford group meetings and so on. And so they changed the thrust of their operations. And this time is our starting time inconvenient, Carol, for you, Barney? We've only had a couple of hours to eat, I understand. I don't mean to embarrass you. And you can take off your sunglasses now you're inside. Anyway, I don't want you to miss this, so I started out with Rebecca to start at the beginning. The first alcohol was brewed in 7,000 years. So as we know, they changed the thrust of their action. Instead of sitting around discussing spiritual insights, which incidentally had never worked for alcoholics, and they decided to try to help somebody else. So they went to the hospital, found this Bill D, this goof from Kentucky, who's drunk and lying, who on a geographic had moved from Denver to Akron some years before, and he was a drinker, he had to get away from it, but he couldn't. And he did drank himself into another set of disgraceful situations in Akron, was in this hospital. And he was very much, I'm sure, like most of us, he had been advised and lectured until he was half crazy from it. And he was married to a very strong woman. I met her some years ago. And so Bill and Dr. Bob wanted to call on him, but she did talk to his wife, apparently, and she told Bill, about Bill Lee, you know, there are two men want to talk to you about your alcohol, about your drinking. And I heard him talk once upon a time. He said, I'm 2001 talk to about drinking. I'm tired of hearing people talk to me about drinking. But my wife insisted, she's a rather strong woman. So I saw them 2 hours. They came and saw me. And we had a couple of meetings, as he said later. Funny thing, they never talked to me about drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt. And I never heard anybody describe me quite so completely. I couldn't believe it. And I stuck with them fellows to them good emotions. They became number three, the first overt action of Alcoholics Anonymous.
they got a couple other guys, and some stayed, most of them didn't stay sober. But in those early days, they were really working on trying to help people. And one of my favorite little anecdotes, some of you know this, they finally got the young guy named Ernie. And he became the first young guy in AA. And they were just pleased with him. And unfortunately, or fortunately, you may look at it, he and Dr. Bob's daughter fell in love and brought a, opened the Pandora's box of AA relationship. I don't know any single word that makes up sponsors back of his neck just shiver when you hear that. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. Oh, shit. If you're really quick, you can say, oh, Mr. Emerson, I didn't do this. A long time ago. I didn't do this. That's true. You may have to listen to it. I know I thought the last one was like, this is, oh, this one really will have to tell you. When I looked up and saw her walking on the detox, I was like, no. Oh, really? If you're busy, you can just put them on the uh-uh machine and walk away. It's kind of an interesting thing too. It's a concept about life, and they know that this is the one. And the example sometimes used, I heard a few years ago, guys tell me, said, you know, God, we had a month today after the morning meeting. We reached for the salt, and our fingers touched, and I swear to God, I could feel a spark. And literally, it was a spark. You don't know whether to have the bad news now or sometime later, you know. This is not what you call your basic love. This is like a teenage infatuation, I should add, or a high school crush or something. Love doesn't really manifest itself that way as a rule. Even in the chance of 1 billion that your relationship lasts for more than 2 hours, you know. If the time should come, God forbid, 3 years from now, you'll be sitting somewhere in your own little bungalow, the white picket fence, maybe a couple of toddlers are going to look over. And you know that you've chosen wisely at last. It's not that you're going to feel the way you feel today, that's not human. You're going to be sitting at a little table there, and you're going to reach for the salt, your hands are going to brush, and you're going to say, give me the goddamn salt. That's just life. That's life. Think about Ernie. And Ernie married Dr. Bob's daughter, which was nice, and the first AA wedding. And of course, it wasn't AA yet, but we can call it AA, it's antecedents. And he didn't have to get into all this action with the other things. He had a young wife, and he would take care of his home. These other people were old guys, their 40s. And he was a young guy, and had to take care of his wife. So they let him not get involved quite so much. And so they were surprised when he got drunk and died drunk. And so upset Dr. Bob saw that she had nothing more to do with the AA speaker for the next 50 years. She's back around now and has been recently for the anniversaries, but she was not Dr. Bob's son's wife, and I talked to him Friday morning, actually yesterday morning. And his wife was passing from cancer in Texas. But anyway, I went on like this, and pretty soon we had a few little cadre members going back to New York, going back to New York, and began working with people. And AA's continued to grow that way we're talking about the Washingtonians, and how they got to so many people, say 600,000 members, would be even so very conservative, say 100,000 sober drunkards in there. Without any telephones, without any cars or anything. Everything had to be one-to-one, right up close and talking into it. And that's why it was in the early days of AA. It really, every day was a missionary day. But they didn't know as much about sobriety as we know now, by any means. For for example, when the book came out in 1939, written in 1938, to fill out, Bill took some kind of successful members and filled up the back pages with stories. And it was reprinted several times over the next few years, with different stories in the back. It's kind of interesting to realize most of those people died drunk. I have a record of all those people, how they came out, and most of them died drunk. Because when they're striking about, they stopped doing the things, they didn't need to do it anymore. And it's an amazing thing, because here's a concept of what we do here based on actions. An analogy I sometimes used to talk about when I was more present, incidentally, just in passing, it's kind of interesting now, isn't it, that there are forces afoot that think we're all going to be cured by sending all the alcoholics to treatment and narcotics addicts to treatment and government expense. And they want, they read the paper, they want alcoholics addicts members to break their anonymity so the government will know how many of them are, so they can all pass this bill so that Hazelden can become multimillionaires. You don't mind doing it if you have a good reason like that. But the concept of action and involvement, and one of the great deterrents in modern day, oddly enough, have been the treatment centers. You know, when I was sober, there weren't any treatment centers. When I got sober, there weren't any, a couple of drying out spots. There weren't any treatment centers. And they came along after I was sober. And all the old timers that I knew in respect, so I took on their coloration, was, ah, the goddamn treatment center, the rest camp, why don't you just get sober, what are you doing? Well, wait. But in the years, I actually softened it, as hopefully matured, and I realized there are good treatment centers and bad treatment centers. And invariably, the bad treatment centers share something that the good treatment centers do not share. And the question is, why would you go to a treatment center anyway? Why would anybody who is sick and desperate go to a treatment center when AA is here free? Well, just to add an example, I used to say that it's like going down to the beach in Santa Monica, where I live. And beyond, if you can't see it, is Catalina Island. So you want to go to Catalina Island, and you walk down the beach, and here's a little, nice little boat, white little boat with white people and white uniforms, and the smell of food wafted out of the galley, and say, won't you come with us? We're the SS Treatment Center. Well, maybe I will, sounds good. And you go down the beach, and here's two guys kind of skulking in some tall grass, saying, you want to go with us? We're AA. We got an invisible boat. Appreciate it, and nice to see you. Good luck to you. If I can get out of that treatment center, but I'm going to go. And it does exactly what it says. It gives you a ride, it tries you off, feeds you, takes care of you, gives you full of information, you're ready to go. It's just wonderful. What's wrong with it? They would probably say, just get out of sight of land. Say, well, that's as far as we go. We have to turn back now and get somebody else. But if we like this, we're not there yet. Well, you're in good shape. Swim like a sunfish. So, and you may get tired and sick. It'll be these two boobs by their invisible boat. Want to ride in our invisible boat? I'm not that sick. You see, you're about to drown again and here they come again. Want to ride? Yes. Here you go. Oh, thank you very much. And suddenly you look around. There's no boat here. We're floating in the air. This is ridiculous. What is this? What am I supposed to do? Grab an arm roll. You're crazy. You swim some more to use my bed. You want to ride? Yes, I do. Grab an arm roll. You crazy bastards. And as you roll, the boat slowly appears. But it doesn't appear until you begin to roll, which is a great problem in AA for males. And eventually you get a boat as big as the size of a treatment center skiff, and you have to be bigger than that, and eventually you don't even want to go to Catalina, you just want to sit on the boat. And does exactly what it says. The irony, of course, is that when you stop rowing, when you get to a size you think you want, you stop rowing long enough, the boat begins to shrink, or sometimes you're already going, and eventually you'll be back in the water. I think, how could this be? I just was on the water. I was on the Titanic, and here I'm swimming. That's what we have sponsors for you. Tobias are up and say, hey, yo, dummy, you got your oar upside down. Oh, yeah, I see right now. I was looking at it needed to remind one another to keep rolling. Now, what's this got to do with the good treatment center and the bad treatment center? Well, the bad treatment center, although they don't actually say it, they imply it. You now know enough to stay sober, what you learned here. You now know enough to swim on your own. And the good treatment center says, you're in good shape now and you're going to swim for a while. But be sure to look for those two groups in the invisible boat and jump in and roll like hell. And that really is the only difference. And the ones that do not subscribe to that philosophy, big chains, comp care, Raleigh Hills, and all kinds of big chains, they've all went bankrupt. And how did they go bankrupt? Because the insurance companies refused to send people away being treated. Why? Because they discovered the same people were going through again and again and again and again. The insurance companies said, we're paying $30,000 a pop to us, that somebody goes through three times a year, baloney. And so they live behind the horse in these places. And a couple of places, a few places have stayed simple and have tried to profess. But no treatment center I'm aware of that has not strongly urged Alcoholics Anonymous upon its graduates has been successful in its maintenance of sobriety. That's why it's kind of sad. This is a good thing now. There's an article in the New Yorker on March 23rd, if everybody will remember that. But this year, a big article on how Hazelwood is now trying to really get away from that 12-step stuff and getting more into drugs and treating people with drugs. That'll be their death knell for them eventually, I suppose, unless they change. But it all gets back to the same thing. What makes people like us stay sober, apparently, are the actions. Now, if you had to choose one action, I suppose the most important action you could choose would be helping others. We don't have to choose one action, and we can enrich our lives a lot of ways. But so many people may come here and think they equate with church. If I can just get to pray good, I'll be all right. And it doesn't work that way, because your alcoholism doesn't know you're praying good. Your alcoholism just knows you're not changing. So one of the steps, which I'd like you to talk about the steps, you've all heard about the steps again and again. You know, there's no action to be taken in the first step at all. You admit you're having a problem with drinking. Dash, end of thought, begin your new thought. You admit you're having a problem with sober. And then people say, I couldn't take that first step, I just couldn't accept it. When you walk in the door, you accept it. Because if either one of those weren't true, you wouldn't become a beer. If I could still drink and get away with it, I'd be drinking. If I could still stay sober and stand it, I would be out there doing it. So when you can't drink and you can't stand being sober, you go to places like AA. You don't even say you have to admit you're an alcoholic. You have to admit you've been hurt a lot, and it's not your fault. We all agree with that, right? And just like I said, it came to be that power grade myself actually showed me the sanity, it's convenient, right? Power grade myself. I used to think that it meant God, that I didn't want to go around, and my sponsor finally told me, he said, you don't have to return to God. Why did you say you returned to God? I said, fucking thump. So now it says you come to believe in something. You gotta try to believe in some power. For God's sake, can't you believe in a power? Can't you believe in AA? No, I can't. Can you believe in God? I said, no, I don't. Because if God exists, then I'll be damned. But I prefer not to believe in God, actually. She said, you think I'm doing better than you are? Yeah.
Congratulations, I'm your new higher power.
And he became a higher power. People used to laugh at that. But I'll tell you this, if you're a double God, I would much rather have you believe in your sponsor that you believe in than to pretend to believe in God you don't believe in. Because it's easy to fool at 8 o'clock at night, but it's almost impossible to fool that dark to 2 in the morning when you're laying alone. You better have somebody you can turn to. Well, if you come to believe somehow this power is going to restore me to sanity, which we extrapolate to mean living in reality without having to induce psychosis to stand it. Yeah. You don't have to wonder how it's going to be done. You just have to try to come to believe it somehow, because it's happening to other people, even though I can't see it can happen to me. Then you're going to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. What the hell does that mean? I can't pay my rent, God. Will you take it? You know what happened then? You sleep in the street. I had to come to understand that in a good sense. That I accepted there's a power within myself, and now I must allow that power to superimpose its perceptions over mine. Then if I get to the first step, that's the first action you gotta take. Go right fear, which the pillar wall over and dry stuff. Click that what we do. I hate to write down things that I'm really, you know, I don't mind writing big things like, oh, I did that. That time was the football field on fire. not the time I smashed up with my little baby's bank to get 50 cents. And not the times I abandoned some girl and now they told her I'd be right back and I really did love her. Nasty, petty, rotten little things I've done. And that's kind of a hard thing to do. Usually it's in my experience that the worse you feel, the more depressed you are, the better inventory you write. When you feel good, it's, oh, I guess I've done a few bad things, but not. Put the column for good things I've done. Usually that is a major action. I suppose that's the first major action in any question of action going to be a song. The first, that's, I bet that is separating one man from boys and women from children and girls and everything in the world, because you have to make, usually for many people, the first inventory is not a very good one. They may have to go back later when they're more secure and right and real. You have to be kind of secure in order to admit how insecure you are. When you're really insecure, you can't admit it. When you're going to read it to someone, it's, in my area, we're very lucky. We didn't have all the benefits and all the insights that many people in the East had and their AUs knew. So we didn't know you had to go find someone you didn't know, some minister 500 miles away, and read your inventory to him. They just wanted to be your sponsor. And then, I believe I risk for being a very sponsor. I don't mind for my sponsor. I risked in hundreds of inventories. And I could back that one. I could remember all the things that were done, and the people who did them, I just don't remember who did what. Are you the one with the sheep in Montana? Kind of how I do. I know in my case, I had to be very desperate. I was going to commit suicide. And my sponsor one day took my pain and got me to write an inventory. And I wrote a sort of set of little things that I never told my psychiatrist ever. Ooh, I wouldn't tell my psychiatrist things. When I was going to talk, why don't you tell your psychiatrist? He said, very simple. If you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. You did what, sir? Get out of my office. Just wash off that chair. But that's a major action. That's a major investment in yourself. That's a humbling action to humble yourself before another man and God and another woman. And they say, why don't you want to take your inventory with your sponsor? Well, why not? You're asking this sponsor to guide you and to save your life and to take the appropriate actions, and yet you don't want them to know how you are. I'm not telling you where I'm starting from. Just try to guess, give me a direction. Silly. There were some silly, some not very complex actions in there. Go and ask God to try to help you become willing to remove these
defects of character. What does that mean? It means if you ask God, you can become willing, he's very willing to be gone? Not at all. You're just trying to prepare yourself to say, I now understand the nature and the sense of my wrongs, and I want to become willing to do whatever is necessary to rid myself of it. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I want to become ready to do it. That's all there is to the sixth step. Since seventh step, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. I've sat in meetings years ago where we debated for an hour the difference between defects of character and shortcomings. And then I finally found out Bill Wilson later wrote, I just made the phrases different so I wouldn't be redundant. They mean exactly the same thing. People always look at you, what do they really mean here? You know, what is Bill? Bullshit. Take that off the tape, you know. That's one of my spiritual messages. Now, Scott, it would be shortcomings. What you're saying, in fact, is, it sounds corny, but I set myself and myself to do as I will. That's a little religious for many people, but you have to work with that. I have to say, okay, I'm very resistant. And then do a few more actions. Well, the next action, of course, that we all know about is you make a list of people you've harmed. The people I work with, I'll make a list of who they harmed and how they harmed them, so get some, in a sentence or two, so get some kind of a picture of it. Then there's an interesting thing. There's a lot of, you put down a lot of names, and if it's been my experience, I've got more than once, or there are a lot of things that don't require an amendment. Because they're not really wrong. So sometimes, it's been my experience, the people you resent usually are the people among the top people you owe amends to. Because I know that I resented a lot of people. When I, once I made amends, I didn't resent them anymore. So it was a funny phenomenon. But you make amends, and of course, as we all know, there's some amends you can't make. You can't make amends to dead people, sometimes people you can't find. I don't like, I was troubled by that, and my sponsor helped me do something, I've helped other people do. He said, sometimes you just have to make an amend to the universe. You find somebody kind of like that person, and then be nice to them, and do something special. Why do you want to do something? A lot of little old ladies have been helped by me, and never knew they would be my grandmother at that moment. And you help people, you try to be, make things right if you can. It's much more romantic than telling than it is than doing. I've been flying to Texas once to go to a company I worked in there. It was about 5 years ago, I hadn't been a chance to make amends with this company yet. And I walked over and this guy fired me. I said, why should you know Doug? It was Doug Perry, not that I remember him. I can't remember where I was last week, but I remember Doug Perry. I want you to know that I have come here to make amends. Come here to make amends for my bad behavior. And he said, well, you should. And I said, well, that isn't what I hope to hear. I don't hear, oh, you're so wonderful. I said, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous now. And that's when such we say. I said, what are you doing in Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, I thought that was for alcoholics. I said, I guess I am an alcoholic, Doug. He said, you're not an alcoholic. You just were a natural born son of a bitch. And I thought, if I go to the table and hit him, I'll come back next year and make another one. Well, okay, Doug. But oddly enough, I never hated that guy after that. I never hated him. One of the kind of interesting men I had to make, I didn't want to make. When I was a senior in college, I'd been hired to teach journalism at Duluth Denfeld High School. And I was in the first class of veterans after the war, we were a rowdy bunch. And wild and weird. So I got up to graduation. I was asked to speak, give a little talk on behalf of the senior class at graduation, and I did. It was wonderful. not sincere, but wonderful. And I think we got a good, when I captioned us, got diplomas. I have a blank diploma. I knew I would because some old bag had given me incomplete English history. So I'd get 3 hours in summer school to get this English history. So I was just working summer school. I got a job at U.S. Rubber Company, balancing white sidewall tires. I was young and strong and went to school. And then I used to build about that bag, give me an incomplete. Then I came off a shift, I sit back in the bar, drinking. And this woman came in, and she was a traveling magazine saleswoman. And we struck up a conversation, and she lured me on. And I finally was prevailed upon to tell her about some trophies I'd won at the university. She didn't think I'd won any trophies. I'll show you. Jumped in a car, her car, drove to the university. The doors were all locked, of course, at 11 at night, so I just kicked in briefly this one door in the administration building. And we went in, and I showed the trophy case, and she was overcome. I was driven on, I can't recall very clearly, but said to me, I thought she'd fainted and had a flat tire or something. I know, I was trying to pump her up there on the floor. And a policeman flashlight in my mind with the picture of it. And we were arrested and then taken to jail and arrested. I tell you, today, in 1950, that was a tough beef. The boy would make you like me campus chaplain, probably. But she was put in jail, I was put in jail, and I went to court the next morning. And what humiliation and disgrace. And just before court started, a guy came in, brought me a note, signed by the dean of the university, DMM. He says, I've tried to cover for you, I've tried to cover for your excesses. I've done it, I had 1 week to go, but you couldn't even do that. You're expelled, stay off this campus, don't ever come on this campus again, don't ever come around here. You make me sick. And next day I got a wire from Duluth and go, your conference has been canceled on a morality clause. All of a sudden I went from something to nothing. It's hard enough to go through this when I explain it to my wife. And those are the good old days, I'll tell you. I don't know, we talked about this at length before. Well, I got a job, worked in the newspapers, writing, all that from off a different direction. And finally, had some ups and downs, and victories and defeats, and finally wound up in ADA. And one of my amends, I mean, I'm going back to that dean who was now president of the university to make amends. And I went back to Wisconsin to see him. I went back to see my folks. I stopped in to see him. Left my name, and she went, I said, she doesn't want to see you. You're not supposed to be on campus. I said, I just need to talk to him for you. She went back in. Sorry. And I didn't make you feel terrible because I was feeling pretty zeal and enthusiasm. So this time I came home to see my folks about 8 months later, I went down there again. And next Sunday I went down there. It's a feeling, well, I've tried to make amends, that's all I need to do. But it's going to be fixated on this, and so the next spring I went down there again. She says, well, the president doesn't seem to understand why you're so insistent. He will see you for a minute, but he's not your commander. You come out there. You come out here. So come out. Yes. And he had been a good friend of mine. He had tried to protect me a few little scrapes. And so I said, President Haas, I'm an alien. I know I screwed up terribly and did terrible things. And that's about all my good. He was like, oh, he said, no, I live. Nice question. I'm sorry. He said, well, you got a right to be sorry. No. So I'm glad to see you doing better. I never thought you would. You see, just misuse every gift you ever given. How's the end of that? Well, the next time I was home, I went down and saw him again. And this time I sat in his office. Well, how are you doing out there? I said, pretty good. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
You need to work on something. You know that, don't you?
Yeah, it's like a little...
This went on for a while. Well, about... I would like to learn about them, and about 20 years later, fall of 1978, I got a call from the secretary saying, Clancy, President Haas is just asking this because we know that you haven't been totally close, but the chairman of the West Coast Alumni Association wants to set up a luncheon for the group, and if he hasn't done it, we don't know where to go. We can't get a hold of any. Could you help us? I said, sure, I'll help you. I had friends at the Biltmore Hotel, which was a big hotel, and went over there and set up this nice room, and that would be historic. Robert Kennedy just been shot there, you know, a few years before. I tried to get him in the same room if I could. Not really, I've just been cute. So we came out here. This was now the spring of 1979. And she called me, I said, as long as you arrange it, would you like to attend? I've never been asked to attend any alumni, because I'm an alumnus. Yeah, I guess so. I guess that'd be great. Thank you. So I went. And people mingled, and some were surprised to see me. Clancy, you know, I've been reading about you in the paper, because I had some articles about me in the paper and my work and so on. They were glad to see me. He said, what's this about your work? I said, good. I said, I'm running a studio mission. So that's why you talked about that. You said you were working in television, maybe in Hollywood. I said, I was, but that's some time ago. I'm running a Skid Row mission. I've changed my lifestyle a little bit. I can't believe this. He said, how about the taking Fred and I over there? Let's see it right now. Don't make any phone calls. I said, okay. He told us up to something. So someone's kind of over there, walked in, and here's this nice, clean, bright old Clancy, took him to my office, and all this, my personal stuff. And I said, I can't believe this. This is a miracle. A selfish, nasty person like you, even pretending to think about this, that's really remarkable. Not so loud, the people can hear you. He seemed to be quite impressed by the end of that. Well, okay, now we jump ahead for 11 months. January 1980. And I get a call from the university. His secretary said, President Haas is retiring at the end of his career. I said, yeah, glad you're here. I hope he's doing well. Has a good time. You know? She said, something kind of strange has happened. I said, what's that? He said, he was named the Distinguished Alumnus of the Year of this university. He'd like to have me come back and speak at commencement in June. And I was overcome. I almost cried. I brought all my kids. My parents were still living then. And they'd gone through this terrible thing before. They were still there. They cried. I gave a talk at commencement on why people should be straight arrows. Eventually, sooner or later. And it was really a touching moment. Nobody ever mentioned the fact that I'd been expelled. It never came up. There was a distinguished alumnus here, like, hello. And it was a touching, beautiful thing. I got thinking about a couple years later, after they started getting alumni assessments from me. You know, this is really wrong. They have alumnus of the year who they expelled and didn't even graduate. That's not fair. So I started signing fun little letters. You know, I gave you an affection for the university to go to my chart. And I want to contribute, but is it really correct to have an alumnus of the year who's not an alumnus? I mean, what is this here? It's after about 5 years of that day, my director alumni said, oh, for God's sake, here's your degree. It's temporary degree. So now I'm a Bachelor of Arts from the University of Wisconsin. I owe it all to just being a good guy. 2 weeks ago, I was speaking in Superior Duluth, the Twin Cities up at the top of Lake Superior. And I told the story, not quite in such detail, but I told the story, I said, just think, here I am living in Hollywood, a lot of many people sponsored by this one, ME3 over the last 4 years, and I know a lot of people in government, a lot of people all over the country, all over the world. I said, just think, if I hadn't been a drunken pig, I'd be here teaching school in Duluth. And they didn't laugh at that old thing. I said, a long and dark story. I don't suppose every time you make an amend, you're going to be named Alumnus of the Year, but that's part of it. I know in my case, the great amends I tried to make was try to become a better son to my father and to my mother. They were divorced when I was a boy. They didn't like each other, they didn't like me much if I liked the other one. So my father and I didn't talk at one time for 10 years. It was very difficult to be a good son, but I treated him as though I was a good son. So I really didn't like him. I thought he deserted me in my time of need. And over the period of years, he and I became very close, closer than most fathers and sons ever do. We got close to death because I lived in our house in California. They got close to dying. He moved back to Wisconsin and died. I was holding his hand. And I often think about that, the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, because my sponsor made me make an amend to him to begin with. I said, no, he owes me the money. He deserved my mother and I. He deserved my wife and I. Screw him. I said, he's a terrible father. My sponsor drew a great line. He may have been a terrible father, but we aren't dealing with that. We're dealing with a guy who's got a terrible son. And we want you to feel good no matter what he does. So we got me to take this action. Over a long period of time, we finally felt the relationship, and I said, we got very close together. But I thought about that a lot of times. I've told that story to a lot of new people. Based on my psychoanalysis and my knowledge and my insights, if you come to me today and say, can't you tell us about your father? I say, well, my father's dead. And based on all my psychoanalysis and study of the situation, I realized that he was a thoughtless, cruel, hard-hearted son of a bitch, and I hope he's in hell, and I hope there are people jabbing him with knives and making him scream in pain, and that can cheer me up. That's what I would say based on, that's how I felt coming out of psychoanalysis. But some company would say, based on your experience today, tell me about your father. And I said, well, my father and I guess we have kind of similar in a lot of ways, but we couldn't connect somehow. And he was doing the best he could, and I was doing the best I could, but neither one of us knew it. But thank God we did something about it before it's too late. As a result of taking actions in here that I absolutely disagreed with, we just became close. Now he's dead, and I hope he's in Valhalla, which is where we do heaven, and I hope he's got a seat open next to him and wait for me to get there. I hope he's saving me a glass of meat, whatever the hell that stuff is. And nothing's changed in our relationship except the actions you're taking on Alcoholics Anonymous. I suppose, in my experience, the amend step are the most important, second only to working with others. Because that is really where you unbring yourself with. Up to there, up to five, maybe even six and seven, that's psychoanalysis. Some of them. You know, getting out of yourself, understanding, agreeing about it there. But the difference would be here to do something about it after we learn about it. That's what this is now for us. This is wrong in most of the people like me. They may not intend to be in psychoanalysis, but most of the people like me. I know a great deal about it, but I still think, but I know about it. You know, it's just like a bunch of people. So it's similar to pants on a street car to tell them. Hope they last in value, but it makes you feel more than what you're doing. I think that's why the book is so specific. It says self-knowledge is not enough. And yet all of us are so used to we're seeking self-knowledge, and that's going to be an answer. But I would say all of these amends is the great action of AA. People do not do that based upon, no, he did me more harm than I did him, so I don't have to make an amend. Do themselves a tremendous justice. Injustice. I don't care what she or he did, I have to prove my side of the card if I'm going to get up here. Then there's some more inventory, daily inventory. I'm in a school of thought today that feels you should write whatever you feel. on a daily basis. And that may work for some people. To me, that smacks of extreme self-obsession, which I'm trying to get out of. And it is me, I, how do I feel, me, I love you. I shouldn't have to write to see how I feel. Then it's off to prayer and meditation and improve my conscience, that's it. That's an action of sorts, I suppose. There are people who take great pride in their hours of meditation. There are people like me who can't do that. I guess I'm what you call a type A personality. About very long meditation is guilty, this gets to me insanity, you know. A lot of people I know, if I went down and destroyed, I say, I want you to sit in the dark and meditate for a couple hours, just meditate. If you're smart, you have your pistol there along with you, she said. In my life, meditation consists of taking such actions as sometimes being stuck in traffic, remembering that God needs good for me. This traffic has nothing to do with it. That God is really sending out some force of good to me. I've got to somehow arrange my receiver to get it from time to time. That's very difficult because I'm a selfish, self-willed, rationalizing, justifying person. And so it's a continual effort to open up the receiver and get some of that stuff in. Well, the final action, of course, is a, it's an interesting thing. People say, what do you mean by spiritual awakening? You know, I've heard that again and again. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to practice these principles and all our prayers. That's fine, but what principles? What are the principles then? Stop and look at it. Any principles really involved is that the man's admitting wrong and living with admitting that you are selfish and just to live outside yourself. It isn't perfect perfection. These principles have to be perfect. The thing that comes to book after this that we're all familiar with, that saves a from being just another series of hopeless promises of religious fanaticisms. Put in order, I can't go through it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like absolute adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual line. The principles we said are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And we'll keep trying. The great thing about AI, I think, is this. You think about New Year's Eve. I'm going to make great. I'm going to change this. And sometimes it will last till 8th of January, sometimes 20th of February, if you have much longer now. Then I have to work on it again next year. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, every day is New Year's Eve. And every morning is New Year's Day. And a lot of times I didn't do really well, but thank God I have to work the next December 31st. Tonight's New Year's Eve, and you may try again tomorrow. But that's a continual action. But the great action for us is to carry this message to alcoholics who still suffer. The basic message of Alcoholics Anonymous, starting with Bill and Dr. Bob and Billy Green and all those guys in 1935, and before that, Billy Wilson, homing the streets of New York, trying to find old drunken guys in bars in that street, and I say, come on, to me, I think I can help you. They're all to go, yeah, come on. And none of them ever help except Billy Wilson said. Of all the things we do, I suppose that's the number one thing. If you had to choose, because it's pretty thing makes you spiritual, maybe, I don't know. I know the number one thing, it gets my mind off of me onto somebody else. And that's almost impossible in my case. Yeah. But when I'm thinking about that sick puke, I'm not thinking about this sick puke. That's one great reason for the 12-step work. And the second great work, of course, and I'm sure that Tom will discuss it in more talks if I get off here. Maybe not. But I've learned more about AA realistically by trying to teach it to someone else than I ever did by listening to it. Because the teacher, I have to learn through my own framework of reference. Oh, that's what that means. I'm a poet. There's no truism in education that is really true. You never really learn a subject until you begin to teach it. then you begin to really know it. That's certainly true in AA. So some sort of wonder that Alcoholics Anonymous specifically said in that line, we all familiar with it. I wish there was a new dummy here so I could tell you some rules, but we all know their ways, so these were true. The book is correct. Action is the magic word. Love, spirituality, wonderfulness, these are all very objects to AA, but without action is nothing. It's just another exercise in futility. And of course, another great line, because we all go through bad times and bad periods sometimes, we're not always appreciated, sometimes we have bad days in every life. We try to do it, we pray, we've done everything we can do. There's another good line. When all else fails, we're another alcoholic. When all else fails, get your sick mind off your sick self-obsession and get back in the world. And it continues to function. It's so easy to forget that. It's so easy once you get a big boat there to lean on your oar. And we all do it from time to time. But don't be surprised when little by little the bush starts to shrink. It doesn't mean it doesn't work anymore. It means you have to start rolling again. And that's why we, as I say, that's why we get together meetings, epic meetings, and all sorts of meetings. Just remind them. Keep going, pal. Keep going. Keep going. Hang in there. It's going to be okay. Thank you.